Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Adam from Toronto, and I support Creative Control because Vish is full stop one of the best arts interviewers in Canada, or anywhere in the world, really. He approaches every episode like he's known the artist for years, creating a conversational atmosphere that gets straight to the heart of the work. No one else in podcasting gets it quite right like he does, with a mixture of meticulous research, wise artistic insights, and well-humored personal connections. I proudly support Vish and Creative Control on Patreon. You should too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Mike Halichuk and Josh Zucker are both musicians from and currently based in Toronto, Ontario. Over the past 20 years, they have worked together in the impressively prolific and ambitious punk rock band Fucked Up, and on other community-minded initiatives like the Long Winter Art, Music, and Subcultural Festival in Toronto. In 2011, Matador Records released David Comes to Life, a remarkable 18-song rock opera by Fucked Up, which was complemented by a number of singles and a compilation of fictional bands called David's Town, which featured a number of special guests. To mark the 10th anniversary of David Comes to Life, Matador is reissuing the album on light bulb yellow vinyl, which is available for pre-order beginning December 10th, 2021. The band plans to tour behind it early in the new year, and then on March 22nd, 2022, Matador issues Do All Words Can Do, which compiles the aforementioned singles and furthers the narrative found on David Comes to Life. To mark all of these events, Mike, Josh, and myself got together on a Friday night to have an hour-long chat about some of these things, but then decided that we didn't really like it, so we got together again the following Friday night, did the whole thing over, and talked about various aspects of the writing, making, and release of David Comes to Life. Love and heartbreak, hope and dread, existential angst, world-building and higher powers, lawsuits and pranks, critics and fans, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners just like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations to sustain the show at patreon.com/creativecontrol with additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and friendly staff who will help you with anything you need, really, when it comes to music and records. Learn more about them at blackbird.ca. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is the 654th episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Mike Halichuk and Josh Zucker of Fucked Up, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Josh, how you doing there?
I'm good, Havish.
It's nice to see you again. It feels like I just saw you the other day, but it's nice to see you again. Where in the world are you?
I'm in Toronto.
That's great. Nice to see you there, Josh. And Mike, are you there?
Yeah.
Nice. Nice to see you, Mike. Where in the world are you?
It's just down the street from Josh.
Are you guys both on the same street?
I think we did this bit to start the last time off.
Yeah, I think we did. The last time we spoke, we figured this out. It's nice to see you both, and it's lovely to see you both. Now, congratulations. It's the anniversary of David Comes to Life, which is exciting. Mike, why is this significant? Why are we celebrating a milestone like this one for this particular record? What would you want to say about that?
Well, we like to make an event, and you know, we'll do a celebration at any opportunity, and 10 years seemed like the exact right one. And we're only like 1 year late, so.
That's right. It's not exactly 10 years. Is it the 11th anniversary?
Well, I believe that it's the 11th anniversary is coming up on this June. So we're going to get this 10th anniversary tour out of the way and immediately go on the 11th year anniversary tour. That's kind of like how they just did the 2020 Euros last summer in 2021.
Yeah, it is confusing. Everything's 2020, even though it's 2021. I've noticed that as well.
For Josh, listening to this podcast in the future, there was aliens that came to Earth and stopped time for 2 years. Like, I mean, people listening to this in like 1,000 years, not people.
A thousand years? Wow.
Yeah.
That is inadvertent high praise for this show, that it would still be relevant 1,000 years from now. That's kind of you, Mike. I appreciate that.
Don't you think that when like our future civilizations will be able to look, just consume all of the data we produced in some way, like almost instantaneously, they'll be so advanced?
Yeah, it's going to be like in the Matrix when Trinity's like, how do I fly a helicopter? Except like future humankind will be like, what was music like at the start of the 21st century? And they'll just like fast forward through all of your podcasts, Vish, and they'll be like, oh, okay, that's what it was like.
I think people are already, they're already doing that with my podcast.
You know when you're having dinner and you have that one friend who, if like a question comes up in conversation, they just go on Google on their phone.
Oh, yeah.
They dip back into the conversation. Like every single person is going to be like that, except with all of knowledge.
Yeah.
Like two people will have a conversation and then instantaneously, like there will just be no questions about anything or no schools, you know?
Well, my wife was lamenting the other day about how kids don't know how to write, you know, print with a pen.
Yeah.
And I was like,
I can't do that.
I know. And I was like,
she's a teacher, right?
No, she's not a teacher, but she was just, but she's in the educational realm, right, so to speak.
That's a very like educator type of thing to lament.
What do you think, Josh?
No, kids can't write.
Do you think it's a factor, though? Like, the only time I write is when I have to write someone a check. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
is it a factor in what?
I don't know, in life. Like, do we have to write? The thing is, like, my kid will just talk to his iPod, Siri, which it's an Apple. I should say it's an Apple product. And he'll say,
everyone knows what Siri is.
Well, some people don't. I'm just trying to catch the folks up.
In the future, you mean?
In the future. This is from 1,000 years. Like, they won't know who Siri was. They'll think it's some Greek god. Anyway.
No, we just decided that they'll know everything.
Oh, that's true. They'll figure that part out, too. But yeah, no, they don't write anything. They're not even texting. He talks to the things, all his machines. So I feel like there is something to it. It's not necessarily writing, but it's typing even. Like, I feel like it's all going to be gone, and maybe that's okay. That's what
I remember when you used to go to the bank to try to like get a check and you'd have to do long division like right there on the counter to get your money.
Yeah.
You don't have to do that anymore.
No, I'm benefiting, frankly.
People don't think about this kind of stuff.
No, it's true. That's why they have us. Anyway, I appreciate that, it's an anniversary edition. Josh, does this record stick out for you as significant for Fucked Up? David Comes to Life is what we were trying to talk about there.
Yeah, it sticks out. I mean, very self-consciously, it's like our most listened to record. And a lot of the songs that we play from it are like songs that people really like. And it was, I think, just a big record for us in terms of like the arc of our career. So yes, big one.
Now, I was digging through the lyrics. I was reading all the song lyrics in order, and it is quite a narrative. But before we get to that, I'm looking at the cover here. I'm showing it to you. You've seen this before, I take it. It's your record. The cover of David Comes to Life, for those who can't see right now, two light bulbs. And the setting, initially anyway, is a light bulb factory. Before we get into the actual cover, Mike, what is the significance of the light bulb? Why is the light bulb primary image here?
They make a heart when you put them together.
I see that on the cover, yes. The light bulbs.
Yeah. We realized recently that a lot of people didn't know, like, didn't see that, really.
Well,
I always thought it was
like
very...
people have tattoos of it.
I always thought that was very heavy-handed.
The fact
apparently,
that it was a heart?
Wasn't heavy,
heart?
Apparently it wasn't heavy-handed enough.
Well, I guess maybe people weren't... I wonder, you're right, it's quite obvious. I've missed this myself. I never thought it was a heart. I thought it was two light bulbs. But they also are going in divergent directions, as some of the characters do as well. So I think I was kind of thinking of it that way. But what is the significance of that, Mike? Why do these two light bulbs form a heart?
Because it's a love story.
You know what, before we talk about that, though, remember how this wasn't actually the original cover?
Yeah, that's true.
So if you...
Vish,
I don't know if you have the record with you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so
I'm showing it to people now. The cover of the album.
Yeah, the people are looking at it.
Well, the people in the call are, but the people listening at home or in their cars or on their jogs.
So you open up David Comes to Life, the vinyl, and the cover is like a piece of cardboard. That comes out. And then the actual LP jacket is this photo with like, I don't know, 20 people in it.
Yeah.
Including all the members of the band.
And Josh's family.
And that photo was taken during the video shoot for Turn the Season, which is song 4 on the record.
I think they recreated it to make the video.
Is that your sister, Josh?
Sister's there, my mom's there, and my dad is there.
And then there's the gatefold.
No, that was definitely the video shoot because like all those people are there.
Where was this? Where was this all happening? What was the venue for the video shoot?
It was a dance studio in Toronto where we shot this video. The video is cool. It's like one shot. Like what's that movie, Birdman?
Oh yeah, yeah. The one track.
So the video is a single shot. And so we sent this photo, which is kind of dark, lots of people, really hard to tell what the hell's going on.
Self-referential.
Yeah, it's got like all of these Easter eggs and stuff in it. So we sent that to Matador and they're like, guys, we love the concept. It's beautiful. but this is not going to play on iTunes. Like this is not going to work as a little, 100 by 100 pixel iTunes graphic, which is kind of the era of music.
They said this in 2011
at the time.
Huh?
Yep.
iTunes was already dictating stuff. That's bad.
They came to Toronto in the winter and took us to like an extremely fancy dinner, all six of us in Toronto. And then we ate for like 2 hours. And then I remember like at the dessert course, one of the Matador guys like pulled out these massive printouts of that photo he had. And they had done this huge fancy dinner for us to soften the blow and say, this cover is a no-go.
Well,
they filled us full of shrimp. What do we eat?
Yeah. We went to Splendido, which is an Italian restaurant on Harbor.
That's nefarious, but tasty. That sounds like it was pleasant, at least. That's a pleasant way to find out. You can't do what you want.
I think me and Damien were pissed, but I really can't remember.
Well, okay, so there's lots of stuff going on in terms of the content and the imagery, but again, the heart. Let's go. So this cardboard thing that Josh was alluding to that isn't really the cover, on the back of it, there's like a poem. It's like a letter to the listener, but on the front is this heart. So what is the significance, Mike, of the heart? It's significant to the story.
It means love.
So
that's generally what it means.
The heart was like a backup. Like this was something that we had to cut. So when we created this cover, we had, you know, you can't tell somebody you can't do this cover because of iTunes, make something else, and then not have to think about iTunes the whole time as you're creating the new cover. So it was very present that like, okay, I guess we need to make something that's going to, you know, pop like 100 by 100 pixels.
So. Okay, so that's why the light bulbs are so prominent. It's a big, striking image. Okay, I get that part. But the light bulb in contemporary culture can mean different things. Obviously, it's illumination, but it can also mean ideas. That's a thing. We had a conversation about this not too long ago, and I suggested that the light bulb reminded me of like ideas above people's heads. And I don't remember. Mike, is that like a valid sort of point to raise about light bulbs?
I believe when you raised it last time, the light bulb may have appeared above your own head while you're having that idea.
But my own head, but there's lots of ideas, so to speak, on this record. Like
speaking of a self-referential idea.
Well, I will say that we re-released a live 12-inch in 2004 entitled Let Likes Be Cured by Likes. And on the inner sleeve of that record is a light bulb with a humunculus baby inside of it, which has a fucked up logo at the very bottom of it. So, you know, we were fucking with light bulbs back in the dark ages of 2004.
Dark ages. You see,
damn, that's true.
So it's mostly a reference to that record because we were like, we're the band that already had a light bulb on our record. And now this is our second one. So there's two light bulbs.
But the action of the album begins in front of a light bulb factory. And there are some, let's call them socialists, pro-union people trying to get the workers to recognize something. What are they trying to get them to do, Mike? What would you say?
I think it was like very general action. I don't really remember the lyrics. But the first song, I think Veronica is like maybe handing out flyers.
Yeah.
So as workers.
Yeah.
Yeah. To be like, you know, go on strike or whatever. And yeah, David, I guess that's how David and her meet. He gets a flyer and their hands connect, and that's their meet cute and all this stuff. Because David, of course, works at the light bulb factory. He's trudging to work in the AM.
Yeah. Right. So Josh, that's their first meeting, right? That's where David and Veronica meet. Is that right?
As the story goes, yeah.
As the story goes. Now, this is based a little bit. He's not here with us, I don't believe, unless he's lurking. Some of this is based on Damien's relationship with his now wife. Is that right? Like when they first met? Is any of that true?
I don't think so. Maybe. I mean,
no.
Have you read that somewhere?
I did read that somewhere. Yeah, I read that. I didn't know.
I think Damien and Lauren probably like met at a show or something. They certainly didn't work to meet at Damien's.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I don't mean the circumstances are specific, but I read something recently that suggested that Damien was basing some of the action of these characters on his own relationship and the courtship that he and his now wife, Lauren, had. Is this news to you? Is this false?
Well, Damien's...
I can definitely see that. Like, just like some of the lyrics and some of the early song, like the first few songs on the record that are about them meeting and their courtship, and then like, yeah, their shoe. That's definitely, I think a lot of Damien's, I don't know, anxieties come through in some of those songs.
I was wondering about whose anxieties there were, because there's a lot of like polarity on the record. I feel a lot of oppositional forces, Mike. And I thought, do you have any take on that? Like, I was thinking of the song Ship of Fools, and there's a lot of like, it's one thing or it's this opposite thing. Like a lot of like oppositional pondering. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah. Like by that song, I think that's like track 13 or 14. By that song, the record, that's what the record is about. It's about a bunch of different, looking at one instance with a bunch of different perspectives. But I will say the weird thing about the record is definitely like, you know, the other shoe is about looking at a good situation you find yourself in with a very, with a lot of anxiety, right? Like being involved in something that's so good that you immediately start worrying that it's all going to come crashing down. And like, that's track three. So it's like, this is our big romantic record. And by already by track three, we're kind of like, this is not going well. You know what I mean? And I think that's something me and Damien both kind of share. But when I, at least when I'm writing lyrics, and especially on this record, I was trying to be extremely buoyant and present like a very hopeful outcome, not like in opposition to Damien, but just that's, I wanted to be like, this is the record about something terrible happening and what happens afterwards and how to become happy again. So, yeah.
But it's, I think that like, Josh, is this some aspect of the band that we should be concerned about? That even when things are good, everyone assumes it's going to go bad. The other shoe will drop, so to speak. You know, there's an expression that I think of when I'm listening to this record, and I feel like I'm going to fumble it. But what is it? It's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And I think it's actually maybe even alluded to at one point. But there's an aspect, Josh.
Did you make that up? That like, line? That's a good line.
Yeah, I did.
That's a great line.
It's side work I do for the Hallmark card company. I write little things for them. But Josh, this notion of this record, it feels like sometimes to me, is that true? Maybe you're better off not trying because things are going to go wrong. I mean, that's some aspect of the sentiment within all the hope and buoyancy that Mike's talking about. I feel there's just like gloom and, you know, dread. Dread is the word I'm thinking of. Do you relate to what I'm saying there, Dread?
Yeah, I think that, like, you know, probably describes some of our outlook. It's kind of just like, you know, our condition. It's like you can't really get away from that. But then you quickly realize that, like, approaching everything with dread is a pretty hopeless way of living your life. So that feeling on its own doesn't last for too long. I don't think about it though as like an allegory for the band dynamic or anything like that. I think it's more like, yeah, probably a few of us definitely just like, that's just the way that we approach life. We're kind of, I don't know, a little bit dark, a little bit pessimistic.
Mike, is that fair?
I will say for like this record sort of trying to be like a meta commentary on something, that exact outlook is something that affected our band right after the release of this record. So I remember these years where we were sort of reaching our apex as a band after this album came out were for me, and I like filled with so much anxiety of being like, oh, we're definitely just going to break up now, because we were, especially Damien, experiencing like a level of success that was becoming hard to sustain with him. He sort of was starting a family around this point too. So I remember like for the next 3 years after this record coming out, just being like, fuck, like we're going to definitely break up. And also I can remember the day, like we were recording in New York and he had come to New York to do some vocals on the record. And that's when he had just gotten a job at the Wedge. And so he was like, we're putting out this awesome music. Record. I have a young child coming. And I just got a job hosting a weekly TV show in Toronto. So I was just like, he was riddled with anxiety to be like, I don't know if I can make a band work in these circumstances that I have as an adult. And I was kind of like, I think the band is going to break up in the wake of this success that we're finally having.
So wait a minute, just to clarify this, Mike, you're saying all of these circumstances occurred once David Comes to Life had been released?
Well, he got the Wedge job while we were recording it.
Oh,
and then
I see.
We released the record and it was, for our standards, it was a successful record. And its success, you know, tracks one and two were quickly met with track three, starting to worry about what that was going to do to our lives, which, you know, a lot of our interviews at that point were like, you know, is fucked up breaking up? Does fucked up only argue with each other?
Yeah.
You know, that went on for a long time.
Did I ask those questions back then? I don't think I did.
Well, just like, you know, like that was Exclaim's thing for like 10 years.
That seemed to be their thing. I remember that. Sam, our friend Sam, would write stories about you. Yeah, it always seemed like that was the hook This band is so great, yeah. But they're on the precipice of breaking up all the time. That's right. I remember that.
That's like the Heather Shoe is like our whole thing.
Do you guys remember, I remember when I worked at CBC Radio 3 and you all came to the studio together? Josh, do you remember this? You came into that little record.
I do remember. I don't remember us all being there.
I think you were. I was surprised you all came, but it felt like you all went to everything. At least when I was involved, like the first time we met, we had breakfast for a thing I was recording. Everyone was there at, I believe it was Aunties and Uncles, and then we did it again.
Most bands don't do that?
No, it'd be like send a couple of emissaries, you know, particularly when they've got a couple of songwriting producer types in the band. They're just like, oh, you go. I'll say everything. But it was
nice. Bands really pile in for the free food.
Well, this was just a free... When I think of the being in the building, I think it was just like... I always thought my perspective fucked up was like, can you believe these people want to talk to us? Can you believe we're going to be on the CBC? Like, I don't think you thought it was like that. You weren't reverential, but I think you were like, can you believe we keep getting away with this?
Not at that point.
No, not yet. Okay. I was just curious.
No, anyway. No. By then we were, you know, it was just another thing to do, but,
yeah.
Anyway. There's always at least probably pretzels at CBC.
Yeah, but there are
maybe some drinks.
You don't know whose hands were in there. Probably someone bad.
I couldn't believe that you were letting us, that you were bringing us on to do your show that aired between 2 and 5 a.m. across northern Canada. That was incredible.
I never had a show like that. It was always 9 a.m. to noon.
What was your show?
The show I had on CBC?
Yeah.
It was in the mornings. It was like a morning show. I think our time, or Ontario time, it was maybe, I want to say it was maybe 6 to 9 a.m. But I might be wrong.
I remember we went to CIUT once to play a live set on a morning show.
Oh, yeah.
We had to get there at like 7 a.m. and just being like, who the fuck wants to listen to this? Listen to our band. Like this in like 2004 when we were still sounded like Chaotic. Who wants to listen to that as they're going to work?
I think lots of people would. I would. If you're tuned into CIUT, which is like a campus community station, you're...
Yeah.
What are you expecting? It's going to be chaotic. It's fine. I don't understand. Anyway, it sounds to me like you were saying, in a weird way, David Comes to Life was prescient about the band's outlook on itself. Like, you didn't realize it maybe at the time. That whole other shoe is going to drop thing, it wasn't always present. Like, but before this, were you guys generally pretty up, Mike? Were you pretty, like... Because I don't think of Fucked Up as a hopeless band. I think of them as a very hopeful band. Before David Comes to Life, were you pretty like, yeah, things are going to be great? Or were you always a little like, fuck, something bad's going to happen?
Well, it's easy to be on the front foot when there's no stakes, right?
Yeah.
And that's something that a lot of bands can ride that for a lot of years, where if you don't need to make a living, or if you don't need to like live up to something you've done previously, if there's no stakes for you to live up to, you can just, you're sort of like a freewheeling artist in the wind. And there's no pressure.
Yeah.
And coming out of this record, I listened to it for the first time in a long time last week. And for like a heartbreak bummer record, it's, the sound of it is like very propulsive, very like, you know, on the front foot, as I said a minute ago. And the years that followed the success of this record definitely like contributed to the sound of the next record, which is like, for our standards of like being extremely upbeat and confident, was not a confident record.
The following record, if I don't have it in front of me, was it Glass Boys? Was that the next one?
Glass Boys, yeah.
Okay. So, and that one...
But yeah, up to this point, we just were like, we were still the band that just like, we wanted to just do funny, weird things without really having a plan or an objective. We just were getting a bit more popular, you know what I mean? Like, at this point, we're like still suing Camel cigarettes for fun. We're still pulling April Fool's jokes on Much Music Live, just, you know, for fun. None of it was like this calculated thing. And then all of a sudden we find ourselves on like a legit label selling records,
yeah,
and going to meetings and stuff.
Josh, Mike just alluded to the April Fool's joke. I believe you were the primary culprit in that April Fool's joke, if memory serves. What was the joke again? Do you mind telling us?
No, it wasn't me primarily. It was a lot. So we went to South by Southwest in March, yeah, of whatever year it was. And when we came back, Mike wrote this really long blog post about, I think, just like commercialization, like just the like rampant consumerism and like commerce kind of going on at South by Southwest, and like just heavy advertising and like the selling of culture and stuff. And it was like, I remember it being like a really smart piece, kind of reflecting on that experience, like personally, but like it was like real super political. And I think a lot of people were into that. And then, so that was kind of like our mindset. And then a couple weeks later, because South by Southwest is like mid-March. So a couple weeks later, April Fools. So we took the lawsuit that we had actually filed against Campbell Cigarettes like a few years earlier, and we photoshopped it and changed it around so that it was an energy drink company called Thriller Energy suing us because for defamation from Mike's article, which like
we retroactively inserted a fake company into the South by Southwest poster and the article so that we could then use that as like the prime document of why we were getting sued by a fake energy drink company.
Right. We inserted after the fact, after we came up with the idea, we inserted Thriller into the original blog post, right?
Right.
And by the way, I think this is like maybe before we had a Twitter or something. Like, I don't remember how we published this, but like,
I think
we had
uploaded the lawsuit, like the PDF, I think, back onto our blog.
Yeah, because we had like a 100-page legal document that we had filed against Rolling Stone and Camel, and we just put the fake name into the lawsuit and put a couple pages on the internet, and so many people felt.
So then we got our friend Mike's roommate at the time, who was like a web designer, to like throw up this website, like thrillerenergy.com, which was really funny. I wish it still existed, just for people to go to. Like, it had no reference to us or the case or anything, but it was just like them selling these energy drinks.
But I remember you made a fake email address to verify it, and we advertised like maybe another fake festival that they had organized. And it was like Chillwave was really big back then. So it was like this energy drink company sort of revolving around the chill wave community, which is very not in need of energy drinks.
Right. That's clever. No, that was a fun time. And you had that, the blog was called, do you still have lookingforgold.blogspot.com?
It's still up, but I haven't written on it in like 8 years or something.
Yeah. I enjoyed that. And the pranks were good. I guess I'm thinking of something on a mixtape. I thought, Josh, you were talking to someone and you tricked someone. That's what
So after we published it that day, there's this media company in Toronto called City Pulse, and they owned Much Music, which is like the national music, like Canada's MTV.
Yeah.
And they owned City TV, which is a TV station. And so like it started to run on CP24, which is, if you're in Toronto, you know what that is. It's like, it's like 24/7 CNN headline news, right? Yeah. It's just like a running ticker of news stories and stuff. So they started to run it there, that like local band effed up has been sued for defamation by Thriller Energy. And then Much Music, like, was like,
even if that was true, like, now, can you imagine that being like, who gives a shit? Like, why would any news company cover some random band getting sued by it? Like, who, you know?
Well,
Much Music, like, I guess, I don't even remember how things were done at that time, but I think they must have emailed us and been like, hey, they probably emailed our fake manager and they're like, would somebody from the band like to come down? And so we went down and we did a live hit on Much Music. It was me and Ben.
That's right.
Because I don't know, like, probably Mike, had, I think Damien was like,
I was in Chicago.
Damien was probably working at the Wedge, or like was lining up that job. So he's
so
like,
he was employed by this company.
And Mike was away. And so me and Ben went, and we just get interviewed. Like, you know, it's like, what was Carson Daly's show?
It was like
Total Request Live.
The after school show.
It was like Much Music version show. Of that. We're like on Total Request Live being interviewed by their VJ.
Yeah.
By the way, and, on April Fools, like on April 1st, it's all happening.
Yeah. So then, and we broke it to them on air. We're like, April Fools, like halfway through the interview.
And I think they just cut. I remember them, Ben, just being like in the middle of an answer, trying to keep a straight face, and just him being like, oh, it's just April Fools. And like sort of made it like a sound. And then I think they did like a hard cut.
Really? Wow.
But also that soundbite is on one of the mixtapes.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I thought that was you, Josh. Yeah. Okay, that's interesting.
It was me and Ben. It was me and Ben talking, and then it was Ben who was like,
April Fools.
And to the guy Devin.
The VJ was pretty pissed. He was like, he was embarrassed.
But that was the whole day that
they'd been had.
You know, that whole network, for those who don't know, they used to be so fun. They would do stuff like that. They would get, you know, they were punks. And then they got all whatever. And so you guys got to them when they were kind of on their decline. Anyway, that's too bad. It's funny stuff. But I was going to say to Josh, because we, just to get back to David for a second, we were showing off the light bulb heart and talking about how this is like a romantic record. But Josh, this is kind of a breakup record, right? It's about a relationship going bad.
Is it a breakup record?
Well, they break up because of Jeff.
Relationship's good. What eventually, what's the first thing that comes between them? It's like another guy.
Veronica dies.
There's death.
Oh, she dies.
The death happens.
She dies in tract five or something.
Yeah, she dies early. Yeah.
They could not continue seeing each other after that.
And then there's like a court case. And then there's like, it is revealed that the point of view is not what we thought. It gets really weird. But yes, just to answer your question again, Josh, the main thing that comes between the relationship is death.
Yeah.
So it's a heartbreak record, maybe? Maybe breakup is the wrong term, but it's a record really about heartbreak.
I would say death could also be sad.
Death,
if you really
death has been
it.
Known to be sad. It depends on your perspective, but yes. Yeah, so it is ostensibly a, like Mike, you were saying, like it's meant to be a pretty upbeat or propulsive record, but it's actually quite dark and sad. Is that fair? Like, I mean the content.
Yeah. It starts from the perspective of David, who goes, I will say we really fridged Veronica on this record. The record would not pass the Bechdel test in our young hubris of making this record. Mm. But the record starts out from the perspective of David, who we feel this heartbreak. He's found the love of his life, and it feels like before it's even started, it's over because she dies by old-timey bomb blowing up in her face. And then he spends a couple songs ruminating about his own sadness and then sort of thinking about what his role in all of it is. And then, of course, he finds himself in a court case being tried for her murder. Because I think what's supposed to happen, it's what's intimated in the record, is that Veronica convinces him to destroy his place of business. They're going to bomb the factory. And they fashion a bomb in his apartment together, and it accidentally blows up and kills her, which is, I think we took that from like something that actually happened to the weathermen in the 60s, a notorious American revolutionary terrorist group. I think they accidentally kept killing themselves or bombing their apartments by making shitty bombs. But so, yeah. And then it's sort of like, we as a band wanted to make a heartfelt record, but not wanting to actually talk about how we felt about our own lives, we sort of masked that in this like show trial in a rock opera about, like, you know, if anyone was like, hey Mike, how are you feeling about your own breakup that you're going through, I would be like, well, just refer to the lyric that David says while he's talking to the untrustworthy narrator Octavio in this the record that we just put out.
Mike, did you ever like refer like a significant other to a song on David Comes to Life, and they're asking you how you're feeling?
Like while we're having an argument?
Yeah,
I do constantly, and they never seem to appreciate it.
This the breakup, the heartbreak stuff, Mike, not every lyricist is here. This was drawn from your own experience a little bit?
I had gone through a breakup maybe in 2010 or something that I suppose I was processing in the writing of this album.
Right. And do you come away from when you finish writing it and you write like when you finish writing this record, because there's a point where the subject David realizes that he's being controlled by a narrator, and then it starts to get quasi spiritual or religious almost. And I don't know if I'm taking us down a wrong road, but there does seem to be some religious imagery or like classic mythology, mythological and religious imagery. Is that fair?
Damien, that's sort of Damien's trade, is he's the guy that goes in for the religion stuff.
Okay. Is he a person of faith?
Yeah.
Or
no, but that's what he he spends a lot of his writing wrestling with those ideas of, I don't know if he was like did church or whatever when he was a kid, but he contends with God on a lot of his songs.
Okay. Well, because
I don't remember any specific spiritual stuff on David.
There's points where trying to find when you're in a place where you're trying to figure out the meaning of life, you know, every yeah. once in a while, those of us who are helpless will look up to the sky and look yeah. up into the ether and be like, okay. What is the point? What is the purpose yeah. of all this? And there are a few instances on the record. And forgive me, because the narratives kind of get all mixed up as you're traversing David Comes to Life. So I don't sometimes know who's even talking. But there are points where someone seems yeah. to be like, help me, someone. Help me with this. I don't know what to do. You're controlling me. And I yeah. can't help but think of someone who's really at a low point calling to whatever, a higher power, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Well, that was us putting ourselves in the record. So the characters being like, mad at us for writing them into such a ridiculous tale. You know what I mean? Like, we were trying to say towards the end of the record that like David was actually mad at fucked up as sort of his fate for putting him in a song with such a wonderful person and then taking her away almost immediately. Like,
yeah,
that was sort of a comic book thing that we were trying to get to, like these characters having sort of their own lives independent for us than us, but us controlling them at the same time.
Yeah. Josh, I just want to go to Josh on this. Like, when you ponder these records and the words that that are written in this band, like, do you feel a particular philosophical or, you know, existential sort of crisis a lot? Like, this one feels that way to me. But what's your take on it?
I don't know. I don't have like a generalized take on. I don't know. It's just people dealing with their feelings.
Yeah, but I guess, so there's this. There's
that's Josh trying not to deal with his.
Yeah, I think I don't mean to put you on the spot with it. I know what you're saying, but I do think this is a record that is wrestling with purpose and what we do with ourselves every day.
Yeah.
Even as workers. So when I think of it in those terms, I wonder if you relate. Like, if it's a band conversation, even like, what are we doing? Why do we do what we do?
Yeah, I think the most like prescient thing on this record from that perspective is kind of the meta story, where it's like the characters are having these really intense emotional things that they're going through. There's like, there's love, there's death, there's like things that they're passionate about, fights that they're having. And then there's like this turn in the story when it's like, but they're characters in a story, and they're kind of their lives and their stories are not their own and not of their own making. So in that way, there's, I guess, maybe like a lot of existential anxiety.
Well, there's also atonement or notions of atonement, you know, like there's a trial, for crying out loud. So it gets into like, what am I doing? And what did I do? Like, I mean, and who is controlling me? Someone else must be responsible. Why does it have to be me? Like, what did you,
I think that like, as an older person, like thinking about this kind of stuff now, I can sort of see like the way you can think about this record and refer it to your own life is sort of like, you know, the shitty things that happen to you in your life, they're just happening, right? Like, they're not happening to you so much. Like, when somebody does something shitty that hurts your feelings, it's like that person isn't doing anything to you. It's just something that's happening, right? So all this stuff that happens in the record, it's like, we as a band try to take responsibility for all those events, like very, very obliquely. Yeah. And there's, you know, a lot of the lyrics refer to us as characters almost that say like, you know, we're the band, we're making up this story. Like, none of these people, even the bad guy in the record, Octavio, we try to give him a redemption by saying like, it's not his fault. It's like, we made him do the stuff in the record that he did, just like we made the bomb go off and we made them fall in love. And sort of, it's like, you know, in your own life, none of this stuff is happening to you. It's just happening. And you're not a character. Like, you do have the free will to react to those things in any way you want, to live your life and the way you see fit, and to try to change your situation, because you know, somebody listened to this record, like, you have your own volition. You can get out of whatever story you're in.
Well, and you have characters that are really, yeah, they're looking for agency too. You know, I was yeah. there, truth I know, like just clinging to some sense of existence, I guess, is where I'm coming from with it. But Anyway, it's not maybe for me. I only have 2 English degrees. I can't figure this out myself. That was like a weird humble brag, and I didn't mean it. But
it's two more than we have in this band.
There's a lot going on. I do want to get to the recording. Josh, do you recall if this was recorded in a way that was different from previous records? Like, was it more piecemeal? Was everyone around for the most part?
I think it was the first. It's not unusual now because it's kind of how we've recorded everything since then. But it was the first time where we weren't really doing it as a collective. We were doing it more. We wrote a lot of the songs collectively in our practice space, but then actually recording them, different people were going in at different times to record their bits. And like the Hidden World and Chemistry was much more like everybody around all the time, band in the studio. This was like drawn out over many months.
Do you know what precipitated that change?
I think it was just how you wanted to do it, right, Mike?
I think this was the first record we wrote as like quote unquote professional musicians. Like I remember writing Chemistry sort of like in my apartment, and I still had a job and stuff. And then, but I think this record, we had all quit our jobs, and I think we were like, okay, we're gonna fucking do this. Like, and I just remember whatever summer we wrote the record in, just like all 5 of us at the practice space, like sort of trying to do like a 9-to-5 situation, just being like, look how serious we are about this band now, where it's like our job. And we ended up writing like 50 or 60 songs in a couple months. And that's where this record came from. And that's why I think that was like really what started the era of us being like, we're just going to write like hours of music and endeavor to try to put it all out in some way.
Yeah.
But yeah. And there were life circumstances, which meant that not everybody could come to all the same recording sessions, but we definitely all were like super gung-ho about being really a really pro band while we were picking up the writing of this one.
So the album is David Comes to Life. There's a song on Hidden World called David Comes to Life. And for those of us who follow Fucked Up, even in a cursory way, you start to recognize that there are little patterns and recurring characters. And David, obviously, the longstanding character. You mentioned 50 or 60 songs. This album, I believe, is what, 18 songs? So about a third of that output. Mike, what happened to the rest of those pieces? I know there were singles and a whole bunch of other things. How many sort of adjacent records to David Comes to Life are there, if you can remember?
The output of this record was 4 singles, so that's 8 songs as sort of introductions to all the characters, and then 18 songs on the record. And then we did another 10 or 12 for the Davidstown thing, which is like, we tried to imagine if there was like a crappy little local record label in the town that the record took place in, if they had put out a comp of like the 10 like worst or best bands in the town, what that would sound like. But then I think just like probably 30 songs were crap. And then they're just like demos on the hard drive.
30 songs are bad, did you just say?
I mean, we probably like when we were going into the studio almost every day for probably 3 or 4 months to write. And we would write a part of a song almost every day. So we ended up with a lot of garbage.
Oh, I see. Okay, so there's...
To get to the good stuff.
So David's town... Where does this world-building impulse come from exactly? I'm going to ask Josh for his perspective on it because you've got at least... Josh, I forget how many like are you writing song lyrics for the band at this point often, or is it mostly Mike and Damien?
It's mostly Mike and Damien, but I wrote just lyrics for 2 songs on one of the singles.
Right. Yeah, you do it, but where do you know like where this world building impulse seems to come from? What's your perspective on it? Where, is it Mike? Is it Damien? Who comes up with this? Like, not only are we going to put out a record, we're going to put out a record where it's like a fake record label in a fake town. Like, where does all that come from, do you think?
I think there's just a part of it is just there's a lot of stuff that we want to do that you can't do. Hmm. Like, as your band, like, you know, having Fucked Up kind of restricts you in some way in terms of like what you can put out. I guess like you know, it has to sound a certain way, and the songs, like, you couldn't put out the Davidstown comp with, like, all these different singers that we had and, like, different styles of music and, like, a fake jazz song and, like, a fake, like, I don't really remember what the songs on that record sound like a garage song or something. Just, like, yeah. Those can't really come out as fucked up songs. But there's, you know, just this, like, desire to write music. And then the world building part is, like, Mike just likes writing all these characters. That's kind of my take.
Is it a God complex that some, is the whole band have a God complex where you have to create all this stuff and then the characters you've created are mad at you from below?
I think the other thing with Davidstown, like, was that wasn't, like, Jonah kind of becomes, like, the, almost the maestro of, like, an orchestra, like, when it comes to a project like Davidstown, which I think is, like, the perfect job for Jonah, is, like, just corral all these different musicians and get them to create an album.
Davidstown was, the record was Damien's idea, and stuff like that just comes about from us, like, spending so many years as, like, record nerds.
Right.
Like, just having experiences, like, every way a record possibly could come out, you know, big or small. Like, me and Damien used to live together, and we would go to, like, every single Lee's Palace show, no matter what it was. And all we did was look up rare records and buy records and try to own. I mean, I feel like Damien's thing was literally to try to own every single punk record that had ever been released.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he had all those comps that weird little towns made of he had all that stuff. And he was like, wouldn't it be cool? A lot of the fucked up ideas are like some idiot like me just being like, wouldn't it be cool if blank? And then we just don't have any like management or fat or like, you know, there's no one to, we didn't have like a team or anybody to really be like, no, that isn't cool. And so that stuff would just happen. Like, if we were a bigger band and I was like, wouldn't it be cool if we just like did a rock opera? Somebody would have been like, no, like that would be stupid. And then it wouldn't happen.
Or they'd be like, yeah, that's cool. But like, maybe I should just focus on like playing some shows.
Yeah.
Like,
what, doing what if you guys put out a really catchy record and had a different name? Like, wouldn't that be cool?
Well, one of the things
you should practice more. invest in a sound guy.
What if you guys all went to therapy?
I like sometimes when I'm watching Fucked Up, I like watching Josh because something funny will happen. And Josh, I feel like you really enjoy the funny stuff the most. Like just the joy of the silliness of being in Fucked Up. Is that fair? Like, do you like it the best when it's like ridiculous, or do you like it when it's serious and like, we're kicking ass, or do you like the preposterousness of it on some level?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a good read. I do like the preposterous. I also like, just as a person, I'm like cursed with just noticing everything. Like, I just
like you I want to say you like will catch, your, something it, will catch your eye on stage, and then you'll giggle. You'll be laughing
it's just,
as you're.
It's not like about. Nothing gets by me, but it's just like I can't not notice something that's happening.
Yeah.
yeah. So there's that. I also just like approach life with like some distance, and so I just have to kind of, I don't know, that's just the way I approach things, like the preposterousness of like everything that the band does, but also like any like bullshit drama that does happen in the band. That's just kind of like my way of the way I deal with that kind of stuff.
Well, Mike was just talking
Josh about, is like the most, he's the most well adjusted in the band, so I feel like he,
to,
you know,
well adjusted to what?
Just to like being a person living in living life. But so if something funny happens, he's just allowed to just have like an unencumbered experience with it. Whereas like me and Damien are too stressed about something on stage to like really laugh. And Jonah and Sandy are kind of like paying attention to some other stuff.
Well, so Mike was just talking about him and Damien collecting records and going to every show. And, you know, Damien being kind of a nerd for that stuff. We were looking at the cover of David Comes to Life earlier, and Mike very quickly said there's lots of Easter eggs there. Do you like the fact that Fucked Up keeps people guessing? Like, no matter what you do, it seems like it creates a little bit of mystery for the people who are receiving it. Do you like that about it?
Yeah, I think that stuff is, like, I don't know. We have a little bit of a sense of humor about what we're doing. Like, and people might look at that and be like, whatever, these guys are the most like egotistical, like do the most artsy shit, like release like Year of the Horse, which is like this just like plodding like hour and a half of like drama. But I don't know. I think when we do like this other stuff, like it's kind of revealing of like there's this other side too.
Yeah. Mike, do you remember how this record was received at the time and whether or not that reception has kind of evolved? I mean, here we are celebrating the 10th anniversary. So people, obviously, your label among them, recognize that there's something special about David Comes to Life. To my knowledge, and I think we talked about this recently, it's the first record by Fucked Up that has like an anniversary edition or an anniversary, a real anniversary celebration, so to speak. But anyway, sorry, Mike, yeah, do you recall how this record was received when it came out?
Yeah, every Fucked Up record is kind of like received in the same way, which is, you know, from magazines and websites, it's usually like enthusiasm that's informed by a very healthy amount of skepticism. Even still, like after 20 years of putting records out, the vibe of our reviews is always like, it seems like begrudgingly we get good reviews a lot of times where it's like, or like, isn't it cute that this like little punk band like accidentally put out a good sounding record? You know what I mean? Like even now it's always, the reviews are just always about, it's like, oh yeah, they put out Year of the Horse. Like, can you imagine how long it is? Or like, yeah, yeah. Isn't it crazy yeah. that they do a, it's never just like, let me just talk about the music and have a, it's always like, and I think that it's just because we somehow are just like still underdogs to most of the world because of, you know, of our name and our just whole thing.
But don't you think, Mike, also there is a segment of the like whatever critics or whatever and fans who get that there's humor and that there's fun? It's not just
And I was, to go back to the previous question, I think like that's how we sort of made the band, right? Like if you have our sound and our singer and our name, we sort of knew early on that we weren't setting ourselves up for a life of like rich and famousness. So we sort of made it our credo to just be like, we will do anything that we think is interesting or fun, because we knew that our trade wasn't going to be like making a lot of money. So that's a lot of the weird shit just comes from that. Like, wouldn't it be funny? And I think like, especially back then, like some ridiculous thing would happen to us like every day. Like I was just remembering Josh, you remember Tall Rob, who was like a huge, one of the like original Fucked Up super fans in like 2002 era, mm-hmm. who went on to get a job writing for like high school science textbooks and like put a bunch of Fucked Up references and lyrics into like a high school calculus textbook or something. Stuff like that would happen to us constantly because, yeah, at that point when we were still sort of this nascent thing, people were in on it. Like people were like, oh yeah, this band is about like doing weird things and would try to do weird stuff like that about us.
Well, you're very funny. Like people listening may not know this, but like obviously we've hung out a bunch. I've seen Fucked Up a lot of times. We've been in all sorts of places like Halifax and I don't know, Guelph.
Halifax, St. John's, Quebec yeah. City.
I don't know about that.
Some of the most beautiful cities in the world.
Sackville, yeah. We've been around, anyway,
all over the world.
I appreciate...
Guelph, Oshawa.
I've always appreciated your sense of fun and sense of humor. It's one of the reasons I like the band, and I like you as people. You're all strange, but so am I. So I enjoy it, and it's... Yeah, no, it's all good. There's a line from a song on David.
What's all good?
Fucked Up.
I thought that was developing into a question.
Okay, fine. I will elaborate. The fact that some people don't get it or get confused or mired in the content or the story of something like David Comes to Life, which, Josh, we will admit it's a somewhat convoluted story, right? It's meant to be a little provocative in terms of messing with temporality. And
are you saying that you don't get it?
I'm trying to argue that, man, I super get it and everyone else is a square. No, yeah. It's a lot.
Those morons.
No, I think there's a lot to get through here. It's very dense and like I say, it hits on for me all sorts of different things. But where I was getting to there for a second, on the song One More Night, I think, and I lost it. I was all going to... Oh, yeah. There's a line here. Do all words can do, David, I still love you. Do all words can do, Mike, is the name of the new singles collection, right? Is that right?
Yep.
Did I get that right? I feel like I got that wrong. It's called Do All Words
Can
Do.
You did it. Yep.
Okay.
You set it up perfectly, Vish.
Okay. I'm undercutting myself. But what is this?
I'm about to take a swing, so set it up.
Okay. What is the significance of extracting that particular lyric from One More Night for this collection of singles?
Well, coincidentally, there's a song on the singles collection that is also called Do All Words Can Do.
Yeah, I saw that. I noticed that too. What does that phrase mean? Where did that come from?
I think that was just trying to play with like the form, how, you know, we're writing lyrics. The characters are sort of bound by the rules that we make. The characters can only do what the words tell them to do, and sort of, you know, extrapolating that to what you can do in your own life, which is more than words. Which, by the way, is the name of another song by, I believe, the band Extreme.
That's right. Extreme had a song from their record.
More Than Words.
I don't remember what the record's called. I feel like the number, there's a Roman numeral 2 in there.
I think the record's called Fucked Up.
Is this a phrase from like some sort of like Eastern philosophy or something? Did you make this up? Do all words can do?
Yeah, do all words can do is my mantra, my transcendental meditation mantra when I was doing my Vipassana in Bhutan as a 19-year-old.
I understood some of that.
Mike actually has a do all words can do tattoo.
Do you? Where is it?
Yeah, but it's not made of words. It's made of like
his lower
ancient
back area.
Eastern symbols.
I'm sorry to hit that so heavy handedly, but I just thought that was interesting that it popped out, you know, because it's an interesting phrase. It's to me, it's an inherently hopeful phrase, but it's interesting to hear it, hear you describe it as sort of, it's like a narrative phrase as well. Anyway,
maybe you'll get a tattoo of it.
I don't have any tattoos. Do you have any tattoos, Mike?
No, Josh doesn't either, unless you got a new one.
Josh, you got a tattoo?
No, I don't.
Aren't we kind of, I'm used to being a minority, but aren't we all kind of minorities in that regard these days, not having any tattoos?
Probably not.
We're probably the least tattooed band in punk rock.
Damien has some.
Damien has a few.
Yeah.
You think the majority of people on Earth have tattoos and that we're the minority because we don't have tattoos?
I think it's getting to that point. Yeah. Everywhere I go, there's tattoos. Everywhere I look.
I think that people that have tattoos are in the minority stuff.
All right. Well, we'll leave this.
You just need to be you. Where do you hang out?
Edmonton.
You only see people with
it's
tattoos.
Just cowboy hats and tattoos everywhere I look. Okay. So I feel pretty good. I feel like we covered a lot of ground. There's an anniversary tour coming in 2022. I want to say it's not happening. Are you playing shows in this before the end of 2021, Mike?
No.
Okay.
January. Probably not.
January, you say, Josh?
Yeah.
And where does the road bring you in the new year?
We're gonna be in Toronto, Montreal. We're gonna be in New York, Boston, DC, Chicago. We go to the West Coast of the U.S.
All the major players.
Going to be going to England.
I don't know why.
Austin, Texas.
I don't know why all the major players made me laugh so much. But it's, yeah, you're doing all the big show. Okay, so where can people...
You're playing all the places band play on band
that's
play
right.
on tour.
Sounds like you are. That's good. Mike, where can people go to learn more about the David Comes to Life reissue and Fucked Up generally these days?
Probably Mixtape 4. I think that was the mixtape that came out right after. We would release a mixtape at the same time as an album to sort of describe it. So I would say people should hit up Mixtape 4.
Am I on that mixtape?
They should go to Mixtape 4.
Go to Mixtape 4.
Go to the .org. Go to the biggest library in your city and demand to see Mixtape 4 from the archives.
Am I on Mixtape 4? I like that. I'm always very flattered. Sometimes you take these interviews we do and you put them on the tape.
Do you know of this thing called main character derangement syndrome?
Yeah, I have it.
Yeah. So whose record are you on, right? Like, what record? What record are we participating in right now that you're the main character?
I'm not the main character. I just thought I was on. All I was getting at is sometimes you take the mic, you will finish an interview like that, and you'll be like, can you send me that? And I'll be like, what? Yeah, I haven't
even. They do that every time.
I haven't.
No, it's. We really appreciate you having us on Mixtape 6.
Yeah.
All I was going to say is I appreciate being on the mixtapes. It's fun.
Wait, is that a real derangement thing, though, or did I just get that from somebody?
I think you made it up.
Then why did you say you knew it was?
Well, I was just trying to be polite. But I think you...
It's probably from one of your nerdy superhero podcasts.
It feels... It sounds like... It does sound like something that...
Come on.
I would have, for sure. Anyway, okay.
It's like a auto-fictional disease.
So if you want to learn more about Fucked Up, everyone, go to Mixtape 4. If we can go out on a song... Oh, wait. Before I do that, this was rude.
Define we.
Well, let's say Josh and I want to go out on a song from David Comes to Life, which is... a great record. Josh, if you could pick a song, like if Mike wasn't here and we could just do whatever we wanted, what song would you pick from the album to go out on?
Let's do...
you don't have to do this, Josh. You don't have to say anything.
Can we do a song on...
Protect your royalties.
Can we do a song on Do All Words Can Do?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So I think you should play Octavio Made the Bomb.
Oh, why did that come to, why did that come to mind?
Just get it all out there.
This is actually the final song on this collection by my records here. So this is the final song.
Give it a little love.
This song is the master key to the whole story. This is the thing, like, so many people bought the album and they're like, oh, it doesn't make any sense. And we're like, well, that's because you didn't buy the 7-inch that came out a year later that only has one song on it. You couldn't get anywhere because we only made 1,000 copies. Like, what did you think was going to happen?
Are these... So these...
You got to read the footnotes.
So the singles that came out at the time are now collected on this collection, but are the actual singles circulating? Can you get them on Discogs or some such site?
No, they all disappeared.
Are they all gone? Were they struck by... Was there
they got snapped out of existence.
They're like that Banksy thing. They all self-destructed.
Was steamrolled in a protest or something? I can see that happening, maybe.
A protest against Fucked Up?
Yeah, a Fucked Up... that's right. Anti-Fucked Up. This is
that
Fucked Up.
At the Exclaim office?
Yeah, I'm not touching that. This is Fucked Up with Octavio Made the Bomb from the new collection, Do All Words Can Do. Hey, wait, when is this collection out again? I don't even remember. Do you know?
March something or other. Maybe March 10th.
Really? It's that far away? So this is a real preview. Josh, this is very kind of you to pick a preview song. That's great. I mean, it's an old
People
song.
People are going to have to wait months to hear a song that came out 11 years ago. It's crazy.
Mike, Josh, I love you very much. Thank you so much for being back on my show. It seems like you were just on, and I wish you the best of luck with everything in the future.
Are you going to acknowledge that this is the second time we tried to do this?
Nice to see you guys. Thanks again.
You got to release the first transcript.
You just have to say goodbye. It's just the end of the episode is just when you say
it. The first time we did this is going to be on Mixtape 6. It's going to be only
instead of playing a song at the end of the podcast, just play the whole first podcast.
Nice to see you guys.
That's a bonus song.
Really great chat. Thanks so much for being back on the show.
I don't know about how this is going.
Bye.
If we don't hang up, the podcast never ends.
Octavio made the bomb. He was the one all along. We grabbed him inside his skull and made him follow along. Had it written down in almost 3 years, so we met at the bomb. Moving the gears, I got a smoothie, I got some fries. So here's what we did, we made a face of our little kid who just wanted to make out and not be a supply about the importance of love and David's lack thereof. And then one of them died, and no one really knows why. And it gets really sad, and David's too bad. He starts blaming himself, fuck the one's life itself. But then you find out that narrator is part of the play. And you start questioning everything in a serious way. You're supposed to relate to it in your own mind. And the characters come in who gets you in his fall. You realize Vivian was with David before the war. The recursive nature of the play becomes clear. Octavio made the bomb. It was the one all along. We trapped him inside a song and made him follow.
in the matrix, how it all resets. And at the end of the series, when they all forget, and Neo's name is written on that bitch. Octavio made the bomb. He was the one all along. We dragged him inside a song and made him follow along.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, thanks again to Mike and Josh from Fucked Up for appearing on this, the 654th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this otherwise completely free podcast, as you may have been able to tell. This episode that you just heard, totally free. But imagine if you could donate some money and then the show just got to keep going and didn't have to worry about, you know, financial constraints. Or think of it this way. You're compensating someone like me for the work they do otherwise for free. Now, $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, which I've just recently adjusted to be not only based on archive material from my audio archives, but also fresh material. So bonus content from the new interview. Stuff you won't hear in the interview. We do a little separate segment. I put it up on the Patreon for the patrons. That's how it goes. So again, if you're interested in any of this, or by the way, if you want to receive a Creative Control t-shirt, that's also from the Patreon. So just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. That address again, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and make your special orders there at their website, blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. As usual, I need to thank my old pal Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim and his intriguing world of music at his website, jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Mike and Josh from Fucked Up. Again, this is part two. Part one will probably never be released, but we talked about David Comes to Life on one Friday. Thought about it, decided just on a feeling. I didn't even listen to it. I haven't put that one together, wondering if it was better than maybe we thought. We just all agreed after it was done, it wasn't quite right. So then we did this. What you're hearing is technically part two, the sequel. That's why in the title it says part two. Will you ever hear part one? Maybe on a Fucked Up mixtape? Maybe? I don't know. As always, Mike has asked me to send him all of these recordings, so I will. We'll see what becomes of them. Anyway, thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you subscribe to the podcast, tell your friends about it, spread the word about it, and that is it. Thank you very much. Listen to David Comes to Life as I have been for the last month. Solid. It's wonderful. Bye for now.
Thank you.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.